Thank you. By the way, you have kind of a long shorm and look fit.
Thank you.
Nick is my hero, man. I just love Nick. This is Behind the Lens, a podcast from The Lens, New Orleans' first nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest newsroom dedicated to unique, investigative, and explanatory journalism. I'm Carolyn Heldman. On this week's episode, the Planning Commission of St. John the Baptist Parish voted to allow heavy industrial uses on a disputed plot on the parish's rural West Bank after years of contentious debate. And under new Governor Jeff Landry, seismic changes to the criminal justice system are worrying some New Orleans law enforcement officials. Those stories, insight, and analysis coming up on Behind the Lens. Joining us this week, environmental reporter Delaney Dreyfus. Hey, Delaney.
Hello.
Criminal justice reporter Nick Krastel. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Carolyn.
And co-editor of The Lens, Katie Rechtdahl. Hey, Katie.
Hey.
So, Delaney, we're going to start with you. We've been watching this years-long battle in St. John the Baptist Parish as Greenfield has been trying to get approvals to build a large grain elevator in a largely rural part of the parish. And last week, they took a big step forward. Will you remind us of the story, who they are, what they want to do, and then we can talk about who's battling this?
Yes. So there's a large swath of agricultural land in Wallace, Louisiana, that has been under debate and talks about environmental justice for decades. It really began in 1990 when the land was slated for a Formosa plastics plant, but ultimately that was not built. The parish president at the time, Lester Millett Jr., went to jail for corrupt tactics. The ordinance that had ruled the land as for industrial use back in 1990 was declared null and void in August of 2023 because he had sidestepped a requirement to bring that ordinance before the Planning Commission. He had tried to, assert that the city council could just make this decision. Mm-hmm. And so since August, we have been watching as St. John the Baptist Parish has worked to try and reinstate this heavy industrial zoning to this swath of land. The swath of land is currently being leased by Greenfield, Louisiana, which plans to build a large grain export terminal that would include a very large grain elevator taller than the Superdome in New Orleans. And allow grain that's coming into the site to be shipped out to international buyers.
Okay. There was a reprieve of sorts that was handed down. Was that in December?
In December, there was a temporary restraining order that prohibited the parish from rezoning the land under a new resolution that they proposed. And that was proposed by the parish president, Jacqueline Hotard, and it was presented in a pre-meeting agenda in a way that the judge ultimately decided was too vague to comply with Louisiana's open meetings law. So the judge asked the parish to make their future agendas much clearer to the public in advance. And also made it clear in November that Parish President Jacqueline Hotard could not put forward the resolution because of potential conflicts of interest.
Okay. All right. And I want to make clear that not everyone in the parish is against Greenfield. There are equal numbers of road signs, at least anecdotally, you have seen that yourself or at meetings. There's equal representation on both sides. So Delaney, what happened at the most recent meeting?
Yes. So earlier in the year, the city council voted to approve this new rezoning resolution that had been put forth by Councilwoman Virgie Johnson. And a vote was placed on the agenda for the Planning Commission for Monday, March 18th. And last week, the commissioners voted 6-2 to rezone the 1,300 acres of land. And it was a very interesting scene. It was a completely packed room. There was not a single seat available. There were people lining up along the back wall. There were people there who clearly opposed the rezoning, and people who had been opposing the rezoning since 1990, people who didn't want Formosa Plastics to come in, people that want to keep this area agriculture, residential. They want it to be rural to fit in with the with how the community is right now. But there was also definitely a group of people who were there in support of Greenfield, stating that they were in support of the economic development that the grain terminal would bring to the region.
Okay. In the article, you write about some people who say that people who grow up in that neighborhood have to leave because there aren't any jobs, and they're hoping that there will be jobs based on this plant. Is there reason to believe that that could come to fruition?
There would be jobs available at this plant. It's unclear who those jobs would go to, if they would not necessarily go to members of the community, but it would bring in a certain kind of economic investment. And it's one that some people are rooting for, and one that other people see as a threat to their health and their way of life. And so this is not a petrochemical plant. It wouldn't be emitting the same toxic air pollution that is prevalent in this area already, but it would possibly emit grain dust and other little particulate matter. But again, Greenfield is saying that their state-of-the-art grain elevator is going to mitigate all of that potential pollution that has happened in older grain elevators.
Delaney, I was just wondering if you could take us to that cemetery where you walked around with that older, that elder from the community. Is Wallace a small little quiet community? Like, I'm wondering about the noise and the hubbub and stuff.
Yes, so Wallace is a small, traditionally Black hamlet. It's founded by former enslaved men who fought in the Civil War and returned to St. John to buy land together. And it still has this feeling of coming into a place where people have been living for generations, and all of the families know each other very intimately, and they take care of the land around them. I visited the street that would be a next door neighbor to this facility. I met a woman named Isabella Poche, and she showed me the above ground tomb of her mother in a nearby cemetery, the Willow Grove Cemetery, which is another one of the historic sites that the Army Corps found could suffer adverse effects from this building. And so beyond this question of whether grain dust can escape from a modern grain elevator, there also is this question that the noise and the lights and all the aspects that are necessary for an export facility, they would change the fabric of the community of Wallace.
Greenfield officials say that they will work with the Corps on these three things I thought were so interesting: mitigation, minimization, and avoidance. Do you know if any of, for example, people from the Whitney or anybody else that might be impacted, did they get a say in what that might mean? Mitigation, minimization, and avoidance for their own personal lives and or businesses when you talk about, or nonprofits when you talk about Whitney?
There have been a number of meetings with the Army Corps. My understanding is a lot of them happened over the course of this study when the Army Corps was trying to determine what was going to be affected. And so I think there is a question now of what happens next, now that the Planning Commission has approved the rezoning of the Greenfield property. And to be clear, that does not mean that the property is now officially rezoned for industrial use. There is another step. It has to go back to the city council. next month. And the Descendants Project, a nonprofit that was founded in 2021 in the area, who has been really pushing back against this construction, filed a motion to block the parish council from rezoning the property based on a number of factors that would impact their daily lives.
I thought that the National Park Service, the sort of analysis of this was kind of nuanced, but also very plain in a certain way. I mean, the idea was that this rural area, this unbuilt up part of the West Bank, was as a whole worth preserving because it provides this sort of sense of history and has tourism value and all those things that we know about what's happening with St. John Parish right now. And so the idea, the reason why people you quoted in that story were opposed to Greenfield was not so much about Wallace itself, but the larger picture of preserving this rural strip of the river as something that was sort of a rare piece, rare section of rural America that is fast disappearing here and elsewhere.
Yeah, that's the idea behind protecting the setting of these places. So there are like five specific places that are could suffer adverse effects, but the whole setting is the whole area, this stretch of River Road is under investigation from the National Parks Department to see whether it should become a National Historic District to protect it in its entirety, as opposed to protecting individual sites. I received an email notifying me that there's a push for registered voters in St. John to sign a specific petition if they are interested in having a meeting with the council chairman. Within parish law requires that if there are 50 registered voters of the parish who sign on to this request, that the council chairman has to convene a special meeting with those concerned constituents. So beyond the motion filed in court, there is also a community push to bring the council chairman together with these concerned citizens in a setting that is not about voting, in a setting that is more about discussion as opposed to public comment before a vote happens.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Opponents of rezoning are also concerned about the proximity of the grain terminal to their homes. And there is some ordinance that says that heavy industrial must be located a minimum of 2,000 feet away. And this is the part where it's getting a little bit tricky, the concentration of one dwelling unit per acre. And now there is some contention about whether that this area fits that description or not. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So the parish council hired a consultant, Jemison and Partners Incorporated, to determine the density of Wallace, to look at how many dwellings there are per acre, to see if there's enough to trigger this, a 2,000 foot separation requirement between the residential land and the heavy industrial land. And they found that there's less than one dwelling per acre. They found one dwelling for every 7 acres. And so the parish asserts, and Greenfield also asserts, that the 2,000 foot separation does not apply in this case. And something, what was interesting about having this meeting with, you know, a period of public comment, was we had two urban planners come forward, Justin Cray and Amy Stelly, and they criticized this analysis as flawed. And they said that because of errors in math, it was not complying with parish law. And what Cray and Stelly are arguing is that that's an unreasonable way to calculate the density of a town that is smaller and confined to the West Bank. It doesn't have homes in the Mississippi River.
Right.
The East Bank is not a part of this community. And if you look at just Wallace, the hamlet of Wallace, it is Stelly's math shows that there are 1.68 dwelling units per acre, which would trigger this required 2,000 foot separation. And so the zoning, Planning and Zoning Commission has voted to approve the rezoning without this necessary 2,000 foot buffer because the parish consultant has said that it's not required. And that is really at the heart of the Descendants Project's motion to block the parish council from officially rezoning the property at this upcoming meeting. Some of the maps that the parish provides that showed if you use the methodology of this consultant, there is not a single community in St. John the Baptist Parish that would qualify for protection from industry. Hmm. And that is really the problem that they were presenting at this meeting. And Greenfield has said that they are going to comply with all parish ordinances, that there is going to be a buffer zone with a 10-foot fence and two lines of trees, and any Greenfield building would be at least 500 feet away from its closest residential neighbor. And that's more than required if the community has less than one dwelling per acre, which is how the parish currently calculates that.
Because this could be the first domino. If this math holds and they allow this rezoning without the 2,000 foot rule, there could be more.
It feels like this is a typical council meeting that we cover. You know, there's an issue before it and you have to rely on the law. But one thing that's very clear about St. John and Wallace is how intimate that population is. Everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows that this is the way things usually go. And the way that things have always gone and have probably gone since those Union soldiers came back from the Civil War and founded Wallace, the same sort of power framework has been in place, right? But the bigger picture is rural America and its, you know, its economy, which has tanked out 20 years ago and is now trying to come back by luring prisons to northern Louisiana and by trying to get a landfill outside of town and all those kinds of things that happen to rural America to try to make money and try to keep their kids close by, right? So this is like a bigger phenomenon, I think, that happens across America and is reflected in this struggle in Wallace.
Right.
So the Banner Sisters are raising this idea, like it's raised in New Orleans, about jazz music and culture here, that you can monetize the culture of a place. But it's very hard, I think, for people to see rural culture being monetized. It's much easier to think of a grain terminal as money versus culture. And I think that this is like playing out in so many places across America that it's a bigger story.
Right, Katie, thank you. You're listening to Behind the Lens. I'm Carolyn Heldman. My guests this week are environmental reporter Delaney Dreyfus, criminal justice reporter Nick Krestel, and co-editor of The Lens, Katie Rechtel.
Hi, I'm Ann Muller, Chief Operating Officer at The Lens. At The Lens, we try to report stories that others aren't or can't. Increasingly, traditional newsrooms are facing budget cuts and have been curtailing long-term investigative reporting because it tends to be the most expensive kind of work. We're here to fill that gap. Without the pressures of filling a daily newspaper or newscast, our staff can dedicate significant time and effort into deeply reporting and analyzing information. As a subscriber to our newsletter, you will hear about these breaking stories first and learn about upcoming events. Sign up today at thelensnola.org/newsletter.
And we promise to not inundate you with emails.
Thank you.
Nick, There's a lot of changes afoot with the new administration up in Baton Rouge. Governor Landry has taken over and has started to put his imprint on the criminal justice system, has some New Orleans officials worried. You can start with a little 30,000-foot view if you want.
Yeah, sure. So kind of immediately after Governor Landry was elected, he announced a plan to have a special session on crime. And the stated goal of this session was to roll back a lot of the criminal justice reform legislation that had been passed under Governor John Bel Edwards in 2017. This was bipartisan reforms to bring down the prison population, reforms to things like parole, good time and sentencing measures. And the idea was to lower the prison population and use that money to reinvest in rehabilitative services and reentry services. But Governor Landry has kind of always been opposed to this. He's blamed these reforms on an increase in crime that, you know, we kind of saw tick up at the start of the pandemic, and this was kind of a nationwide surge, but he really identified these reforms as the cause of it and came in saying he wanted to undo them and subsequently did. So some of the big things and the things that I think will likely impact New Orleans, which we'll talk about, are legislation that now all 17-year-olds will be charged as adults in the criminal justice system. And this was how it was, you know, before 2017. There was a presumption that if you're 17, you're an adult in the eyes of the criminal justice system. But that changed. So now 17-year-olds, if they're arrested in New Orleans, will need to be brought to the adult jail starting in April. They also got rid of parole, meaning that going forward, those things won't be possible. And so what the sheriff has said is that's likely going to balloon the jail population because people will be less likely to take plea deals to you know, resolve their cases, are going to be more likely to go to trial because their sentences are likely going to be longer. And, you know, we'll kind of see how that plays out. I think there's kind of a broad consensus among, you know, people in both political parties that all this legislation will likely, you know, increase the prison population. And how that, you know, directly impacts the pretrial jail population, I think, sort of remains to be seen. But the sheriff certainly suspects that it's likely to increase it. You know, and then we can also talk about some changes to gun laws. There's a permitless concealed carry law that passed this session. And kind of separately from the special session, there's agreements now to bring in the state police and allow state prosecutors to prosecute some cases here. So those, I think, are maybe the big things impacting the local criminal justice situation.
Right. Let's talk about the population piece, because that's a huge one for New Orleans. 2019, the city council passed a cap on the local jail population because historically New Orleans had been one of the most incarcerated places in the country. And they set a cap at 1250 in 2019 with the change. What do they do? Can't stand.
It's a good question. I mean, yeah. So I was just looking at the jail population snapshot, and right now it's at 1,185. So, you know, right up there close to the limit. And I'm not exactly sure what the sheriff will do once it starts to get, you know, untenable to keep bringing people in. She has in the past moved some detainees to Angola. There are some being held in other parishes. So there's the possibility that they look to contract out with other agencies because I don't think that the goal of the city council ordinance was to limit the number of people who could specifically be housed in this jail. It was to reduce the number of people that were incarcerating in the city. But the language of the ordinance is confined to the jail itself. So, you know, there's nothing, as far as I can tell, in the law that would prevent her from, you know, sending people out and saying we're still below this cap. So I think it kind of remains to be seen, and there could be ways in which the other actors in the criminal legal system get involved through kind of doing a triage of who's in jail, who maybe doesn't need to be there, whose bails are being set too high, things like that. So I think there's likely once if it really becomes an issue, there could be some discussions among those sectors and you know, trying to figure out ways to lower the population that way, but not sure yet.
What was crazy is when they did the raise the age, they built a whole new facility, like a whole new wing at the Juvenile Justice Intervention Center, right, to accommodate the 17-year-olds. There's no way to, like, name that an adult facility and be done with this. But, like, it feels like there's – we have the space that was specifically created for 17-year-olds. You know, it's kind of crazy. And nothing has changed except – in either case except the law.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I haven't heard any discussion of using that facility, and I don't know what would be required to – you know, the new law requires that they go to an adult jail, and I don't know what would be sufficient under that to satisfy that requirement. But in really, I mean, what's being discussed by the sheriff is finding space within the current jail. And even after the Raise the Age legislation passed in 2017, there were still, until about 2020, juveniles being held in the adult jail, and these were kids who were being charged as adults. And when kids are charged as adults, it becomes up to the discretion of the judge whether or not they're going to be held in a juvenile facility or an adult facility. And sometimes they were transferred to the jail. And, you know, they need to be separated from adult detainees, so they would have separate pods for juveniles. I was just looking back at a monitor's report from 2021, and at the time, they had a single juvenile female detainee, and because she needed to be separated both from the male juveniles and from any adults, they were housing her in the temporary detention center, which is a jail facility that's separate from the normal jail and, you know, a ways away, and she was being held there alone. And, you know, this is a problem that you run into when you're housing juveniles in adult jails when they need to be separate, is that they sometimes rely on, you know, solitary confinement or something kind of resembling solitary confinement where they're separated from everyone else. And it still requires a you know, dedicated staffing to house them over there. And it can become a real problem. So that's, you know, some of what the concerns are for the sheriff. And, you know, quite frankly, there have been a lot of issues at the jail, and I think she's been struggling to kind of get a handle on the ones that are already, you know, the staffing has been a huge issue. There's been a pretty high level of violence over the last several years, and this throws in a whole another factor.
Right. And adding to that, you mentioned this already, but I want to touch on it, is the de facto end of parole. That dramatically changes the average stay, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, what some people have argued is that sentencing, that judges will factor this into their sentencing so that, you know, that people will actually, it will, you know, maybe even out to some degree. And really, it's just a change in sort of proponents of the change argue is that victims of crimes and don't understand what the actual sentences are, that people are getting out much earlier than they anticipate in this. Removes that confusion. Also, obviously, removes the discretion of the parole board to kind of identify people who they feel have earned and deserve a chance at release.
Yeah, I would wonder about the administrators of the facilities if they are a little bit nervous about that being taken away, the carrot.
It's a good question because the Department of Corrections has historically really been a proponent of the justice reforms that were implemented in 2017. And there was some question, I think, when Governor Landry got elected, whether or not he would replace the head of the Department of Corrections, who's been there for a long time, James LeBlanc, because he's been quite outspoken about it, but he hasn't, and James LeBlanc is still there. But I'm not really sure what his thoughts are on these changes. As far as I can tell, DOC hasn't really come out and been vocal about how these things are going to impact their operations.
Okay. All right. And then let's do a quick roundup of our local officials and how they're responding to this. D.A. Williams, NOPD Chief Kirkpatrick, and Sheriff Hudson. What's everyone saying so far? We have notably Sheriff Hudson wrote a piece. It's an op-ed on our website, thelensnola.org.
Yeah. I mean, Sheriff Hudson, I think, probably is most uniformly opposed, at least to the extent that it impacts her operations. She's concerned about the rising jail population. She's concerned about having to navigate having juveniles in the facility. And she feels like is going to cost her a lot of money that hasn't been allocated to her. In terms of the DA and the police chief, you know, I think there's been kind of two sides to both of the responses. The DA, obviously, as we've talked about, came to this agreement with the state attorney general's office. It was actually while Landry was still the attorney general, to allow the attorney general's office to prosecute all cases brought by the state police in the city. So kind of handing over a pretty significant degree of power and authority to the state attorney general's office, which was a pretty remarkable move. And, you know, stood up there at a press conference and said, you know, he may be a Republican, I may be a Democrat, but we're both focused on kind of stopping crime. Since then, he's spoken out against some of the measures that were passed during the special session. He compared it to the end of Reconstruction and kind of the white supremacist backlash to, you know, the period after the Civil War when Black people were granted all sorts of, you know, voting rights and access to public office. And kind of similarly to backlash against the civil rights era legislation. So that's a pretty, you know, serious repudiation of some of the stuff that went on. At the same time, you know, like I said, he's up there, you know, partnering with these same agencies. So it's hard to know exactly where he stands on some of this, which, you know, has been maybe a feature of his administration. We've talked a lot about.
It does feel like in the national speeches, like the State of the Union and the response to the State of the Union, there were all these fact checks about actually crime is down, where it's down from where it was. And that's a misstatement if you say that crime's never been worse. I feel like we're hearing some of the same stuff at the State House here. Can you kind of give us a little reality check on some of that as well?
The reality is there was a serious spike in crime and violent crime in the city, kind of starting in 2020 and through 2022. But this year to date, there's been a pretty dramatic decline. So in terms of homicides, it's down 41% from last year. Shootings down 35%. Carjackings down 46%. Armed robberies down 51%. This is before any of the state police are not in the cities yet. None of the kind of new laws have been implemented yet. So these are things that are kind of occurring pre-implementation of the special session crime package, already trending down. They're still slightly above where we were in 2019 in terms of crime. But that was, the city had the lowest homicide rate in like 50 years in 2019. So that was a really, you know, low bar for how things have historically been in terms of crime and violence in the city. But it's definitely trending down right now. I think similarly, Kirkpatrick has been supportive of the idea of Louisiana State Police coming in. I think her most outspoken criticism has been against this concealed carry, permitless concealed carry law that I think she believes is going to make the job of the police much more difficult. You know, I'll also say there was a NOPD consent decree hearing last week, and the federal judge said that the state police wouldn't be, you know, subject to any of the consent decree provisions, which has been a concern among advocates that the state police are going to come in and, you know, not abide by any of the policies that the department has sort of worked to implement over a decade of this reform effort. And, you know, the judge sort of echoed those concerns. She said that the state police hadn't presented a clear plan of how they're going to be operating in the city, how they're going to be coordinating with NOPD, and, you know, sort of suggested that NOPD could fall back into some of their problematic behavior with the state police coming in. Since then, Jeff Landry has suggested that the federal judge should be impeached, Judge Susie Morgan, by Congress, which is exceedingly rare and I think unlikely to actually occur. But, you know, there's some real tension there, obviously. And we'll see what happens when we get a little clearer plan from the state police over how they're going to be operating, if we get that plan, and when they actually, you know, show up.
Yep, we'll see. Thanks, Nick.
Yeah, thank you.
See you later, guys.
Thanks, guys. All right, bye.
Bye. All right, bye-bye.
This is Behind the Lens, a podcast from The Lens, New Orleans' first nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest newsroom. The Lens aims to provide the information and analysis necessary to advocate for more accountable and just governance. I'm Carolyn Heldman. Thanks to our guests this week, environmental reporter Delaney Dreyfus, criminal justice reporter Nick Krastol, and co-editor of The Lens, Katie Rechtall. You can read all the week's other news, plus opinions, at our website, thelensnola.org. Thanks for listening.